I want to see science serve a useful purpose to improve the standard of living for all people.
Why is anyone fighting food advance? A very small percentage of the world's population is fortunate enough to have the luxury of turning down food.
We've arranged a society based on science and technology in which nobody understands anything about science and technology.
You can't build a peaceful world on empty stomachs and human misery.
You're listening to Talking Biotech, a weekly podcast illuminating issues in agricultural and medical biotechnology. Your questions and concerns are addressed using a science-based approach with the goal of driving discovery to application with communication. Now here's your host, Dr. Kevin Folta.
Yeah, welcome to episode 2 of Talking Biotech. It's a weekly podcast that really reinforces the idea of driving discovery to application by greasing the skids with communication. And I think so much of our inability to accept good technologies and sound scientific ideas really comes from our inability and maybe our failure as scientists and as companies that work in science to effectively communicate the ideas with really a concerned public, with people who are worried about the engineered mosquitoes or the engineered salmon that's been in the pipeline or many of the other innovations that are coming about. And it slows innovation for those who really need it. So the purpose of this podcast is to help understand or help teach some of the ideas, and even more than teach, maybe appeal to people's interests and intellect and show them that this isn't magic, this isn't something dark and scary, that this really is just the next step of science, and actually it's kind of a dated and weird step of science at this point, something we've been doing for several decades, and better stuff on the way. So in order for us to get to bring the future forward fast, and in order to have innovations for people who could use them every day, whether it's in business in the industrialized world, farmers in the industrialized world, or the neediest of the poor throughout the world, talking biotech is really maybe the first step into getting these technologies disseminated in ways where they can be of the most use for everyone. So today's episode has really three parts, and this is how they'll be going forward. The first is an interview with Dr. Allison Van Enenem from University of California, Davis. She has a new technology she's doing with her collaborators that allow animals to be raised in a much more humane way, and I think it's really exciting technology and excellent use of biotechnology. I will answer your questions in a question and answer session, that questions that have come to me from the hashtag Talking Biotech. And finally, we'll wrap up with an amazing crop story, an amazing crop history, where we talk about the domestication of the blueberry and breeding of blueberries with Dr. Paul Lyrene. So with that, we'll start with our interview with Dr. Allison Van Enenem. Today's guest on Talking Biotech, we're really lucky to have one of the all-stars from animal science and science communication with us today, Dr. Allison Van Enenem. Dr. Van Enenem is a cooperative extension specialist at the University of California, Davis in the Department of Animal Science. She completed a BS degrees with honors from University of Melbourne, a master's degree in animal science, and a PhD in genetics from University of California, Davis. But what's exciting about Allison's background, aside from being a very well-published scientist, is really in a set of awards that are just outstanding for her work in extension and her work in communication. So in a podcast that really is about biotechnology and talking about biotechnology, Allison is really a very logical first guest. Over the last year, Allison and I have found ourselves together in several venues talking biotech, and as it applies to plants and animals, and really a perfect guest for this. And she comes to us today from the Philippines, right? So you're in the future.
I am. I'm already tomorrow.
Okay, could you?
It's looking good so far tomorrow, Kevin, just for you to know. So, yep. You'll enjoy tomorrow.
Nothing crazy happened overnight I have to worry about?
Nope, you can rest assured.
So Allison, I really wanted to have Allison on because she really frames a great question for how biotechnology needs to be used in the future and how some of the ways it could be used in wonderful humane treatment of animals. And so would you like to just give a brief kind of a synopsis of the project?
Sure, Kevin. You probably, people are saying, humane treatment of animals? What are you talking about? You know, GMOs are all about plants. But actually, you can also use genetic engineering in animals. And that's kind of the area of focus of my program. And some of the new tools that we can use enable us to do things like select for disease-resistant cattle, or I think the project you're probably talking about is potentially use what's called genome editing to enable us to modify animals so that they, in our case, don't grow horns. And people may not know that dairy cattle, for example, grow horns and they're manually removed. And there's a genetic approach that's present in, for example, Angus cattle, where they don't grow horns, and we're able to basically move that genetics into the dairy cattle, the Holstein, the black and white ones that make milk, so that they'll genetically not grow horns, and we won't have to manually remove them.
Now, could we even go back a little bit? What is the story with manual removal? I mean, it seems like I've caught like a toenail on the, you know, on a carpet or something, and it's been really painful. And I can only imagine that this would be something that would be a challenge for an animal.
Yeah, so it's basically done using a process called scooping, and it's not very pleasant. It's usually done on young calves, and it's something that is painful for the animal. And the reason we remove the horns is that the cattle can hurt each other with their horns and also people with their horns. And historically, of course, they needed them when they were out in the wild to fend off prey animals, but that's really not how we raise them now. And so if we can just move this naturally occurring mutation from the Angus breed into the Holstein milk breeds, then we'd be able to genetically solve a problem that's an animal welfare concern to both farmers and the public alike.
Okay, and it also really changes the humanitarian nature of the running of the bulls.
Yes, it could totally change that dynamic, I guess, Kevin, if we were to have some of our animals there.
you mentioned this idea of using this genetic approach, this CRISPR, I don't know, genome editing approach. And most people are not familiar with this. They really think about this idea of genetic engineering as adding a gene or maybe silencing a gene. But could you give us like kind of the very layperson description of how genome editing works?
Right. So it's kind of a new set of tools, if you will. So, you know, historically, when you've made a GMO, so to speak, you've maybe moved a gene from, I don't know, a bacteria into a plant that gives it some characteristic like insect resistance or something like that. But what we can do now is actually go in and look at the 3 billion base pairs that make up a cow genome and very precisely change, one or two nucleotides or base pairs, the building blocks of DNA, to a sequence that we predetermine that should have. So we're not moving genes in from other species. We're actually, in our case, just replicating a naturally occurring allele or base pair change such that they no longer grow horns. So it's kind of removing the horn growing gene, if you will, or making it the same as a naturally occurring gene that makes, for example, Angus cattle not grow horns. And so it's really very precise technique that allows you to go in and just make base pairs in the changes in the existing DNA. It's a really exciting technology, I think, and one that can be used for really useful purposes like the genetic dehorning or perhaps also developing disease-resistant animals. So going in and changing a gene where maybe a disease or a microbe binds in the genome, and so that you could basically enable cattle to be resistant to diseases and therefore not get sick and not have to be treated with antibiotics and the like. So there's a lot of, you know, I think really valuable uses this technology could be put to.
And just to give a good idea, just maybe a quick analogy, is that we're thinking about DNA as like the spiral staircase thing with the steps going across, or maybe better yet, like a ladder. What you're telling me is that you guys were able to change really just a maybe one or two rungs on that ladder, and that ladder goes from here to the moon.
Yeah, that's pretty much right. We went in and took out a couple of those steps and changed them for a different style of step. So changed a couple of base pairs to different base pairs, which actually inactivated the gene that causes horns to grow.
And it's really interesting because we will talk about CRISPR and other genome editing tools on the podcast in the future, but it's really exciting to see something like this already in use. But here's the devil's advocate question, is that, all right, you say you bring in a natural mutation that already occurs somewhere in among cattle, and so why not just breed it in?
Well, that's the catch, right? So if you think about dairy cattle, they're really perfectly suited to produce milk, and that's what they've selected for. They're selected to be what's called dairy type. And if you think about a beef cow, for example, Angus, they've been selected to be really good beef cattle. And if you were to make a cross in that gene from the beef cattle, you'd bring along all of that beef genetics, so to speak, into the hybrid or the F1 or the crossed progeny that would result, which sure enough wouldn't grow horns, but it would also have all half of its genes from beef breeds, which have not been selected for dairy type. And therefore, you'd have a dramatic reduction in the milk production of that particular animal. And so that's really, as a geneticist, you don't want to bring along all of that extra information from the beef cattle. What you'd like to do is leave all of the good dairy genetics in place and just go in and precisely change those one or two stairs so that you still have all the amazing genetics for dairy production. You just don't happen to grow horns. And so that's the beauty of this, is you don't get what's called linkage drag, where you bring along all this other unwanted, in this case, beef genetics into a dairy cow.
Yeah, I've heard that described before by others as a really great house in a bad neighborhood. You just want to bring that one thing someplace else, but you can't do it without bringing along a substantial part of the surroundings, that you're not just moving a gene, you're moving all of the other, you're moving 50% of a genome along with it. So back to the ladder analogy, about half of the ladder going from here to the moon would be changed versus doing that one change that you really understand and you know in this gene. So what is this?
And Kevin, to make you realize, I know you're a plant breeder, Kevin, and maybe you work with Arabidopsis that has a generation every 6 weeks or something, but when we're talking about cattle, if I was to try to take that animal that's now half beef and cross it back to dairy cattle to get the dairy genetics back, it would take me a lifetime to get back to the dairy cow I had at the beginning there, while still getting that horned the polled genotype, in other words, the cow that doesn't grow horns. And so it's also a matter of time, that it would just take a really long time to introgress or back cross that gene in from beef cattle into dairy cattle.
And so how do you know which gene to edit? How has this one been determined? And do we anticipate other changes that may come from it other than the horns?
Basically the molecular geneticists have what's called mapped the gene, or kind of found out where this gene is located, and it's on a chromosome 1 in the bovine genome, and we know very precisely what that sequence is. And of course, it's a sequence that's in many beef cattle breeds, and so it's one that we've worked with for years. It basically stops them growing horns, and there's no other effects of that particular gene. And of course, we've been eating animals without horns, or polled cattle, they're called, for years, and so there's no real safety concerns. We're just basically inactivating a gene that results in the growth of horns in dairy cattle, and that's something that we'd like to solve genetically, and that's our objective.
It's really exciting. And how far along is this project at this point?
So this project is actually funded by the USDA. It's a collaboration between a company and the University of California at Davis. And so it is a publicly funded project, which I think is really exciting too, because we're starting to see this technology getting used by public sector scientists. And, you know, with genetic engineering, we've been pretty much locked out of being able to use some of these breeding techniques because it's just been basically the domain of large companies. And so I think these genome editing and these new techniques actually open up the opportunity for public sector breeders such as myself to start making improvements in our plants and animal species for agriculture, which historically has been kind of the role of the land-grant universities.
That's really great, and I can imagine that having a more humane or a I guess it is humane treatment of animals, a more humane solution to the removal of horns just by not growing them is really just another way that helps us use genetics and our really cool biotechnology tools to help animal welfare. And are there any animals that are currently available either as genetically engineered or genome edited?
There is actually a tropical fish called glowfish, or it's not really a tropical fish, it's an aquarium fish that's fluorescent. It's got a fluorescent gene in it, different colors, orange and green and the like, that are available. And they're really more of an ornamental purpose. But as of now, there's been no genetically engineered animals approved for food anywhere in the world, and that's been an issue because we really haven't been able to use the technology as a result of that the very complex regulations that you have to go through to get genetically engineered animals approved. There's a fast growing salmon that's been in regulatory for 20 years and still hasn't got a decision as to whether it can be commercialized or not, and so that's really been pretty discouraging as an animal breeder because it really precludes us using a lot of these breeding techniques. And so these new techniques, I think, open up the opportunity for us to now start doing some really useful things and I think, you know, solving some of these animal welfare concerns and animal disease problems with genetics is just such a better solution than having to, you know, treat sick animals or perform painful procedures. And it's really something that animal breeders have been doing for years, and that is trying to select animals that are optimally suited to the environment and less likely to get sick and are therefore using genetics rather than chemicals to solve problems of animal agriculture.
How are animal genetics potentially able to be used to increase sustainability?
Well, that's a really good question, Kevin, and I think it's not really well appreciated the impact that improved genetics has had both in animals and plants on the sustainability equation, and it relates to the productivity of agricultural production systems. And so if you look, for example, at a dairy cow today versus 1950, we used to have somewhere around about 26 million dairy cattle in the United States, and we now have only 9, and yet we're producing way more milk than we did in the 1950s with that very small dairy cattle population. And that's because the cows have improved productivity as a result of genetics. And so that's effectively reduced the carbon footprint of a glass of milk by about two-thirds relative to the 1950s. And so although it's not often thought in this way, I think genetics has a real role to play in sustainability, both in terms of this reduced environmental footprint of animal protein, and then also the types of applications we've been discussing today of animals that don't get sick and have are genetically improved to not have to have procedures carried out on them or be treated with chemicals, but rather solve those problems of animal agriculture with genetics.
Well, that's really wonderful to hear some of the ways in which this is being used. And if you don't mind, maybe I'd like to just wrap up today by asking you a couple other questions about something else that you do well. And last week I had the opportunity to see you give a talk that was probably my favorite talk I've seen a scientist give in my life. And it had to do with the way scientists communicate with the public. And as somebody who frequently reaches out to public audiences and engages the public, how do you feel it's shifting? Do you think that we're making any headway as scientists as we discuss these issues with the public?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're slowly learning, Kevin. You know, as scientists, we get taught to be very unemotive and to just present data, and that's fine in scientific meetings, but it's kind of the death knell if you're presenting to a public audience, because they hate it if you just give facts and you don't have any humanity or humor associated with your presentation. And so I think it's important that we make sure when we're talking to public audiences that they understand that the passion and why we have the passion we do for the science we do. And you know, I love science and I really enjoy animal genetics, and I want to, you know, show people that is a passion of mine. And I think that we can talk about these topics without having to get really boring and really lengthy and giving long detailed explanations. And it's that's kind of the challenge that scientists are faced with.
And so how do you, how would you recommend, so there's a lot of scientists or maybe not scientists, but people who enjoy science who really would like to get involved in the conversation. And so what is really the first step in your opinion?
Well, I guess a very simple step would be, the internet certainly provides a venue for people to have opinions. And I think we've seen some exciting trends now where we're starting to have science getting injected into some of these very controversial topics, and there's just groups of people who are standing up for science in these internet dialogues. And if you can start to have several people standing up for science in internet dialogues, then you start to get kind of a little group there that starts to question the dominant paradigm of some of these groups that are spreading misinformation. And that's a really easy way to start to get involved there, I think.
Yeah, I always thought the scientists would solve these problems, especially in communication, but it's the nerds. It's been amazing just watching the groundswell of interest in, because this is like the ultimate Lego kit, right? That the fact that you can build something or change something just by making predictable changes in a gene, like in the polled cattle, or other kinds of changes, that it's kind of the ultimate, you know, Lego set or Erector set. And I think that really stirs the imagination of people online, and especially in those groups. And they've been really valuable in elevating the discussion.
Yeah, and I think also, I think even a lot of the traits maybe that have been brought to market, things like insect resistant, maybe people didn't have a really strong feeling that crops were being eaten by insects, but maybe these types of applications, I mean, people can understand that you'd ideally not want to grow horns if you have to manually remove them. And so maybe it's kind of an area that the general public can understand be a benefit to the animal's welfare, and something that I think is something good to be done with this technology.
Well, Dr. Allison Van Eenennaam, one of our first guests on Talking Biotech, thank you so much for joining us. And where can people find you online if they wanted to correspond through social media or through email?
Sure. So my Twitter handle is BioBeef, my website is at the Animal Science Department at UC Davis. It's Animal Biotech. If you Google that, you'll find it. And I have all of my research there, and you can have a look at some of the projects we're working on in terms of disease resistance and selecting for that in beef cattle and dairy cattle.
And all of that is really exciting, too. You've told me of some wonderful projects that are going on in your lab, and I hope that sometime in the future you'll come back and join us again on Talking Biotech. Thank you so much, Allison.
Okay, thanks a lot, Kevin. Bye.
And Dr. Van Eenennaam is a cooperative extension specialist at the University of California, Davis, in the Department of Animal Science.
What can you do to help spread science through Talking Biotech? Our goal is to advance discovery to application with communication, ensuring the best technology reaches farmers, consumers, the environment, and the needy. Talking Biotech podcast is 100% funded by the Kevin Folta Family Vacation Budget, and no contributions or advertisers will be solicited or accepted. Can do is kindly take a few minutes and write a short review of this podcast on iTunes, tell a friend, or scratch talkingbiotechpodcast.com into a bathroom stall at Chipotle. If you have any questions, send them to talkingbiotech@gmail.com or through Twitter at Talking Biotech. A podcast dedicated to these important issues is long overdue. Your assistance can help others find helpful information, will accelerate research, and bring innovative solutions to those that need them.
This is the section of Talking Biotech where I answer your questions from the web. And I really hope if you have questions or concerns, or if you know somebody who has concerns, or they just really would like to have an opinion of a scientist who's studied this for a long time, have them reach out. I'd be really excited to answer those questions. Do that by going into Twitter and using the hashtag Talking Biotech, or even use the email, and you can go to talkingbiotech@gmail.com.
We'd love to answer your questions. Just use the hashtag TalkingBiotech.
So a good question comes from Daniel Mitchell, which is at Dr. Mitchell at 85, something like that. What are the legitimate concerns for GMO? And that's a really good question, because everything has its strengths and weaknesses. And there's some things that we really could see working better if we were able to use GMO technology, or when we use GMO technology. And so one of the at least the weaknesses, some of the things that leave some room to be desired, come from the current technologies, that when you use one technology, let's say for weed or insect control, that you end up with a situation where nature evolves around it very quickly. And we see this problem with weeds, that with continuous use of glyphosate as a single herbicide, that weeds will, well, some weeds were always resistant, and there's 9 different physiological mechanisms or biochemical mechanisms to confer resistance to glyphosate. And the weeds just don't die from glyphosate. And when you kill everything else, they grow into that space very quickly and can become problematic. Other types of weeds developed, have evolved resistance. It's evolution in action. Scientists always knew it would happen. It's no surprise. It's happened later than anticipated, some will say. But that's one major concern, is the lack of effectiveness of very good technologies. We see a similar thing starting to happen with insect control, that the BT genes that have served very well over time to confer resistance to or to confer insect protection are starting to break down as well, that there's cases where insects are surviving. And it happens for various reasons, but the basic idea is when you use one approach to solve the problem, nature finds its way around those approaches. The main problems that I see in terms of concerns is just that decisions about the technology, this is more philosophical, decisions about the application of the technology are not being made by scientists. They're being more dictated by activists, and at least they're slowing down the dissemination or the deployment of technologies that could be very helpful to the 4 areas I care about, and that's the environment, the needy, the farmer, and the consumer. So those are the areas I always think about. The next question would be, let's see, how does transgenic implantation affect the structure of a plant's DNA? How does the foreign gene expression influence others? And that comes from Elias. Elias, that's a really good question. And we've known for a long time that you can drop a gene into a genome. And again, this is it's not really random, but it's certainly not targeted, at least not with the current technologies. That's coming soon. The random integration of DNA into a genome does sometimes disrupt or affect other genes in the area. And we've known this all along. It doesn't necessarily have much of an effect unless it lands into a gene of important function. And if that happens, you really see something happen in the plant anyway, and those are plants that wouldn't be used in production. You can't have a plant that's impaired going into a production scenario. It just wouldn't work. And nowadays, I mentioned this on the previous podcast, that it's so simple to sequence a genome that you can find out exactly where a gene has landed in the genome. And once you know where it's landed, you can tell precisely if it has affected a gene or if it's changing some sort of genomic structural topology. More importantly, you also can understand how genes are expressed very simply on a global scale. And it's easy to take a snapshot of what genes are expressed and compare them in transgenic versus non-transgenic, or I should say GMO versus non-GMO plants. And so it's really nowadays very simple for us to understand how a gene that's incorporated is where it is structurally, where it's landed, and how it's functioning. And with those two pieces of information, it allows us to further understand whether or not there's a need for concern with further investigation into the product. And let me go down one more here. So the next question is, what are the differences between pesticides and herbicides used in organic versus GMO farming? So GMO farming, we just say conventional agriculture, for the most part, with most of our transgenic crops, use an herbicide called glyphosate. And glyphosate is a reasonably innocuous herbicide. It's listed as very low toxicity in most evaluations. The MSDS sheet will tell you low toxicity, doesn't have much dermal penetration. It's if you ingest the concentrate, it can have some health effects, like acute health effects, but the thresholds are very high. It's safer than table salt in most applications. You have to consume something like, the amounts are rather substantial before you have physiological effects. The other side of that are the insecticides that are used in conventional farming, which really have decreased to almost nothing since the advent of BT. So BT is a protein that is installed inside corn and inside cotton, and others, like now we're going to see eggplant, at least that's in Bangladesh. Those crops have this protein that interferes with certain insects, so in this case caterpillars that consume the plant, and corn borers, these kind of things. They interfere with their digestion and those organisms die. So they're excellent antifeedants towards a suite of different insect pests. They give the advantage of not requiring a spray plane flying over to treat a field, which is wonderful because less insecticide in the environment. So BT has been an excellent choice for farmers to decrease the amount of insect they require on their fields. To contrast that against organic, really it's appropriate to start with BT. BT is applied to organic crops as something called Dipel, which is essentially bacterial spores with a flow compound that allows you to essentially spray bacterial spores onto the plant that then, when consumed, do the same job that the GM crop does. Essentially, the caterpillar eats the spores, it eats the protein that's in the spores, and it destroys its stomach. It's a very, very specific lock-and-key mechanism that kills only the caterpillars and can't harm you. In general, other organic ones include copper, copper sulfate, and other copper preparations. Copper is a heavy metal. It's an excellent antimicrobial. Since it's a naturally occurring compound, it's not regulated in any special way, and it's considered acceptable for organic cultivation. And there have been a number of studies that have been done, quite a few actually, but some of them, one of them sticks out for me is, I think it's spelled Bahlai, B-A-H-L-A-I et al., is a group from Guelph, who compared some synthetic versus organic chemicals for pesticides. One of the organic ones they noted was mineral oil, which was applied at the rate of 11 liters per acre. So a heavy dose of mineral oil that breaks the oxygen exchange on things like mites and other insects and arachnids. And one of the problems there is that they also destroy beneficials. And so ladybugs and other beneficials were harmed. And this is not the case with something like BT that either in an organic or in a conventional context confers a safe effect for beneficials. Other compounds include things like copper, which can be used in safe ways. It's inorganic, is used about 6 pounds per acre at times, which, although is not very toxic to humans, certainly can have effects on soil, and in near aquatic environments can have profound effects, so it has to be used with care. And also spinosad can have some very strong effects on mollusks, It's a neurotoxin in insects that can affect other arthropods, or no, other mollusks. And I guess the overall take home message is that all of these methods really do key off of and require safe use of insect control and weed control methods, and all of them are safe. Anything that's been applied here can be and certainly could be used incorrectly, and something that we always should wash our food when we're using it. But in general, the insecticides and herbicides that are being used are lumped together as pesticides and can be used safely in all of our farming contexts and production methods.
With that, it's the end of questions and answers for this week, but please send your questions to or complaints or things I get wrong, it happens, to me at talkingbiotech@gmail.com or to the hashtag talkingbiotech.
Now it's time for Amazing Crop History.
Okay, so today's interview on Talking Biotech, in our section on crop genetic improvement and crop domestication, I'm actually sitting with Dr. Paul Lyrene. And Dr. Paul Lyrene is a professor emeritus at University of Florida and has been very well known for his huge contributions to the Florida blueberry industry. And what we'll talk about today is crop domestication. So, so Dr. Lyrene, if you could tell me a little bit about where do blueberries come from naturally, and where do we find them, or where did people first find them for domestication?
Well, first thing to say is that blueberries are a very diverse group, and anything that's in the genus Vaccinium could be called a blueberry. This genus has about 400 species worldwide, and it is believed that the genus originated in the tropical highlands. And it just so happens that the blueberries of world commercial importance now evolved in eastern North America.
Okay, so that's really interesting. So even things like cranberries, which are also Ericaceae, or
they're even Vaccinium.
Oh, they're Vaccinium. So mm-hmm. So you are related to the blueberries. And the other thing you said there is that they were from North America, which really makes them rather unique, because most of the food items we eat don't have evolutionary origins in North America. Is that correct?
As Charles Darwin pointed out in The Origin of the Species, most of the world's important crops come from a very few little, what he didn't call them centers of origin. They later got that name by Vavilov. But Darwin very clearly explained and noted that there were just certain parts of the world that seemed to be the hearthbed of all the crops that are important today. And his explanation for it is, I believe, correct. And that is that it takes farmers to make crops, and the biodiversity is present in all of the different continents, but unless you have a long history of agriculture, you don't have domestication.
Well, that's really interesting. So that comes from Darwin?
That's comes from Darwin about 1860.
Oh, I missed that one. I just kind of started with Vavilov. That's about where I picked up.
Well, you know, for years I taught plant breeding, and I always attributed it to Vavilov as well. But when I reread The Origin of the Species, it's clearly spelled out better than Vavilov did.
Oh, that's really, I'll have to go back and check that out. Mm-hmm. But what about when you talk about the blueberry in North America, what does the ancestral form of blueberry really look like?
Well, people have been, like pre-European days, people gathered blueberries from the forest. And there are about 20 different species of vacciniums that are closely related to each other that were gathered by Indians in different parts of North America and used to pound with bear meat and make something that would store over winter. So about any place you go in eastern North America, particularly in mountainous areas or in places where fire burns frequently, you'll find some blueberry that makes a quite edible berry.
Oh, that's really interesting. And so did Native Americans have any hand in the genetic improvement, either, you know, certainly consciously or unconsciously? Is there any evidence to suggest that they actually did some breeding?
There's no evidence that they did anything to improve the blueberry. And you can go out in the woods now and find blueberries that they're very they're very widespread, and there's not any indication that there were certain regions where the berries were much larger than what you find elsewhere. So I would say no, that they didn't domesticate the blueberry.
And so I know that you've even gone out and, you know, wandered through swamps and riverbeds and things looking for relatives or looking for vaccinium species, so the blueberry species. And so where do you normally find them in North America? Are there any places in particular that are particularly interesting specimens that maybe the play more of a role in the modern cultivated blueberry?
Well, the original blueberry domestication occurred by the USDA in Washington, D.C., and the wild stock that was used for that came from southern New Jersey and from New Hampshire, and they were hybrids basically between a low-growing type and the highbush blueberry. And I have been to those locations and looked at those berries in the forest to see, and I've seen some of the selections are still there that they used to start the foundation material, and they are not better than what you find growing wild in North Florida.
That's interesting. So they just picked the wrong ones, or you say not better, but about the same then?
They are about the same, but it's just the blueberries are everywhere, and it just so happens that the one person who got interested in domesticating them first and worked on it for a long time was working in Washington, D.C., and he bought a farm in New Hampshire, an old abandoned farm. There was a lot of farming in New England that was abandoned during the 1800s as farmers moved out to the prairie states. And these abandoned farms grew up in many things, including blueberries.
And so so you had this kind of industry that was forming around these new varieties up north. When was that really taking root, and when was that expanding?
Well, Frederick Coville was the USDA person who first domesticated the blueberry. He started making crosses between 1900 and 1910. And he had the cooperation of a woman called Elizabeth White in Whitesville. I guess it's called Whitesville, Whitesburg, something in southern New Jersey, who had a cranberry farm. And they also, as part of the cranberry farm, gathered wild blueberries from the forest and packaged them up and sold them in Philadelphia and nearby places. So when Coville got interested in trying to make crosses with blueberries, he and Elizabeth White organized so that the pickers of the wild blueberries in the forest would identify bushes that had unusually good fruit. And those were ones that Coville then brought back to the greenhouse to cross to make the next generation. So the first actual plantings that were commercial were in about 1925 to 1928.
Oh, that's really interesting, because it also reminds us that these ideas of that people automatically think, well, we have these heirlooms or really old ancient varieties that go back, you know, hundreds of years, but really these are, you know, within the last 100 years, really more recently derived. Is there anything else about the original domestication that we really need to think about?
Well, blueberries, as you mentioned, are in family Ericaceae, and that's the azalea rhododendron mountain laurel family. And there are essentially no food crops that come from that family. It's quite unusual to have anything you can eat that's produced in that family. In fact, the only other thing I know of other than the vacciniums would be the huckleberries, which are quite closely related but a different genus. So when Coville started trying to domesticate this crop, he found that he could not grow those plants in his garden. And he said, they're growing all over in the woods. Why can't I grow them in the garden? So he had to discover what the peculiar requirements are of growing the blueberry. The most important that he discovered is that they want a very low soil pH. Most crops want a pH of, say, 6 to 7. Blueberries like it best around 4 to 4.5. They also could not be fertilized with very much fertilizer, and I've been working with some wild blueberries recently, and I think the commercial ones that we've developed are much more tolerant to fertilizer than the ones from the forest, because I can put on the slightest amount of fertilizer and all the leaves will fall off the plants. So there, and he had to learn how to propagate them. Blueberry cultivars are clones, so they're vegetatively propagated. The plants are cross-pollinated by bees, and if you plant 100 seeds from one plant, every seedling will be different. So in order to have a commercial production, you need uniformity and high quality, and that comes from cloning the plants.
And that's a point that people often don't understand. And so many of our crop plants, whether you're talking blueberries or citrus or apple trees or strawberries, these all come from a single plant, which was an elite plant that had some traits that somehow a breeder was able to bring all of these important traits into one genetic background. And then that genetic background was then propagated using different methods to produce millions of new plants that all come from that one founder plant. So that's a really important point. So what happened here in Florida? So you talk about what happened up north in the northern high bush, but what were some of the things that happened? Because right now the industry is massive here in the state, but it wasn't always that way. And maybe you could tell me a little bit more about how that started.
Well, the first blueberries cultivated in Florida were planted in 1893, and they were a type of blueberry called the rabbit eye blueberry, which is native particularly out in West Florida around Crestview, but also some in the upper Suwannee River Valley. And during the 1920s, there was a planting of various people planted these rabbit eye blueberries, and there were maybe 2,000 or 3,000 acres in Florida. The plants were just dug up out of the forest and lined out in rows. They planted them about 600 plants per acre, put them, I think they were like 12 feet by 12 feet, and they used mules to plow both directions between the plants. Since the plants were seedlings dug up from the forest without any pre-consideration of the berry quality, the fields were highly variable in the quality of the fruit. So it was the 1920s was a crazy time in Florida. People were promoting every possible crop that could be grown and getting Yankees from up north to plant these things where the commercial possibilities were not very high, but nobody realized that until 10 or 15 years later. So that industry basically failed, and the breeding of a blueberry that would grow in the far south actually started with the domestication of the rabbit eye blueberry, the same species that I was referring to that was grown in 1893 in Florida. And that effort was cooperative between the USDA in Washington, D.C., and University of Georgia in Tifton. So when I was this would be like 50 years ago, they released some early varieties called Garden Blue, Tiff Blue, Woodard, and five or six others that were very easy to grow, very successful, but they had one major problem, and that is they ripened during July and August when grown in Florida. And one of the things that's important in growing fresh fruit is that you don't have too much rain and too much heat during the harvest season. Because, well, there's a whole long list of reasons why it doesn't work well to harvest when it rains every day and when there's a lot of dew in the morning. The fruit just doesn't last as long, and the quality is not good, and it's very uncomfortable to harvest. So, and the other problem was that the blueberries that were being domesticated in New Jersey and Washington, D.C., were different species, and they ripened very early. So you could plant blueberries in North Carolina, and they would ripen a month before blueberries grown in Florida. Even though we had a month advantage in terms of the climate, we had a two-month disadvantage in terms of the species. So Ralph Sharp, when he came to Florida, he came about 1948. He started breeding blueberries about 1952. And his idea was to take the blueberries that ripened early from New Jersey and adapt them to Florida. And he could go in the forest around Gainesville and see that blueberries ripened in May. And so he said, if we can take these northern highbush blueberries get them to grow in Florida, then we can harvest nice big blueberries in May instead of in July and August.
Well, that's really it's another interesting point that people who don't understand what plant breeders do and what plant breeding is, so much of it may be taking a variety that's that works well somewhere else, or I shouldn't say a variety, a species or a variety, I guess a variety, and adapting it to a specific environment that that is suitable for cultivation or that is available for cultivation, or maybe presents a unique market window if something can be bred to work within that. And so what happened from there? Because back when Ralph Sharp was doing this, there wasn't very many acres. And then, so what were some of the big breakthroughs that really led to the big change in cultivation here?
Well, when Ralph Sharp decided to do this project, he consulted with the blueberry breeders in Washington, D.C., who had domesticated the northern highbush blueberry, what has now become called the northern highbush blueberry. And they started with stock from New Jersey and New Hampshire. He asked them which of the Florida native blueberry species should he cross with the cultivars or the cultivated blueberries from New Jersey to launch his breeding project. And it turns out that there's 8 different species of blueberries in Florida, 6 of which are quite closely related to the types they were growing in New Jersey. So he asked 2 different experts and got 2 different advices, and they finally ended up using a fire-adapted evergreen low-growing blueberry called Vaccinium darrowi. It didn't have a common name, but it's adapted to piney woods that's burned over frequently. It's almost a Florida endemic. You find a little bit in South Georgia and South Alabama, but 98% of the acres of this wild blueberry are in the peninsula of Florida.
And so this plant is, and I've seen this plant before, it doesn't look like a real good production plant. It's small and maybe smaller berries. And so this was the one that he used to cross with the northern highbush to initiate this new line of berries for here?
Yeah, the reason he was they ended up using that species is that it grows all the way down to the south end of the peninsula, so there's not any problem with mild winters. And also it's evergreen, which they didn't realize at the time, but it turned out to have enormous consequences. Even during the last 20 years, we've just found out one reason why evergreenness is extremely important. If they had chosen any other species of the other ones that grow in Florida other than the evergreens, it would not be possible to grow blueberries in the tropics, which is now being undertaken.
And so that really does bring us to kind of modern times, where blueberry cultivation now is a real mainstay throughout the eastern North America anyway. And you see this in going on in Europe in places like Spain. You have South America in Chile predominantly, I believe. Are those really the major growing regions now that allow us to have fresh fruit year-round?
Well, one of the interesting things about blueberries is that as late as 1977, when I started to work with them, you could not buy fresh blueberries in any supermarket in Florida except in June and July. And even throughout the entire United States, you could not buy fresh blueberries in the market other than starting about May 20, when North Carolina produced them, and ending about maybe September 20, when Michigan had its last berries. That was absolutely the end of the blueberry season. It was like one-third of the year you could buy fresh blueberries. The rest of the year you could buy frozen ones, but nobody was growing them during the other two-thirds of the year. So what Ralph Sharp saw was that he could start growing blueberry. He could have blueberries ripen at least 1 month earlier than they did in North Carolina. So his intention was to add 1 month to the beginning of the season. So Florida shipped its first blueberries using the Sharp varieties between 1980 and 1982. And an interesting market feature was that the growers in Florida who were growing rabbit eyes were selling their berries for about 50 cents a pound. And the first of these early ripening blueberries that were shipped out of Florida in 1982, they brought $5 a pound. And that would be like $12 a pound in today's dollars. So it was like nobody could believe they could sell those blueberries for that much.
And that I even recall, and I'm not, you know, I'm 48 years old, but I remember commercials on TV that used to say, you know, summer fruits are here, and blueberries were part of that. And so this is another important part for those listening, that plant breeders are not just trying to adapt plants to a specific region, but also to exploit really nice market commercial marketing niches that really can help the farmers get the optimal dollars. And so was that really where you came into this and where the industry really took off?
One of the things that made blueberry, I guess the whole world blueberry consumption and production when I started in 1977, and this could be checked, but it was probably about maybe 50 million pounds per year. And now it's very close to 1 billion pounds per year, which is a 20-fold increase, I believe. And what really propelled that partially was the development of new varieties, the extension of the season in North America by the earlier varieties, but also the blueberry was taken to the southern hemisphere. And what that did was it basically added 6 more months of the year when you could have fresh blueberries. So starting about 1985 and then between 85 and 90, when the Florida blueberries were taken to the southern hemisphere and also the northern hybrids were taken to the southern hemisphere, marketing companies started providing blueberries every day of the year, fresh.
So where is blueberry breeding going in the future? And what do you see as some of the maybe new technologies and new innovations?
About 20 years ago, a grower who was testing some of our varieties reported to me that he had a test selection from us that he called Crunchy Blue. That is, it was like, I would say, a carrot. And we eventually named that thing Blue Crisp. And it was a sort of a very firm textured, almost crisp berry. Subsequently, we released one called Sweet Crisp, and more recently, Indigo Crisp. And there seems to be a gene. Most characters in blueberries are multigenic. They're like it's more of a quantitative trait than a qualitative trait. But there's a gene that makes those berries either crisp or not crisp. And I would predict that most of the machine-harvested berries, blueberries in the future, will have this gene.
And that's, I should note that the reason they have mechanical harvesting is just because blueberries that we see now are predominantly hand-picked, well, at least many are hand-picked, and the hand-harvesting is getting harder and harder to come by. If you are going to make a new variety of blueberry or put out the cross from recurrent selection, how many berries or how many individual plants do you have to look at, does a breeder like you look at, in an average season?
The way we did it, typically we would make 100 different crosses involving 200 different plants, and each plant had a different genotype. And we would grow from each of those 100 crosses, 100 seedlings. So we'd have, if you cross two plants in blueberry, because they're heterozygous, no two of the seedlings are alike. So even though they're a full SIB family, every plant is different within that group. So we would then have 10,000 seedlings because we had 100 families from 100 and 100 plants of each family. So then we would look at the 10,000 seedlings every year and pick out the best 200 to use as parents to do the next round of selection. So I saw my program as having two different prongs to it. One was developing cultivars. One was to develop better parents. And the recurrent selection process in which one generation, one cycle of selection builds upon the progress of all previous cycles, you want to make that wheel turn around as fast as possible because every time you turn it, you get better and better and better.
And that's really, it's something I think that when people hear these kinds of stories, and I know it worked this way for me, is that once I understood how this worked, and you know me, it's been very recent that I've come to appreciate these things, that it really changes the way you think about every piece of fruit and every vegetable, and it really gives us a lot of ideas of how far these come from bushes in the woods to tens of thousands of seedlings that are screened, or tens of thousands of plants that are screened on an annual basis in order to provide a continued sustained production of new varieties. So anything else that we should talk about, or anything else?
Well, one other interesting thing, and it's kind of what I'm working on as my retirement project, is all the blueberries that are cultivated worldwide now are based on this little group that's native in eastern North America, which are basically, now they're called North American blueberries, and they're all from one group of very closely related species. If you go beyond that little group of closely related species, you have the cranberry, you have the lingonberry, you have the bilberry, and there's various other more distantly related blueberries. In Florida, we've got two others that are they're farther out from the commercial blueberries, one the sparkleberry and one the deerberry. And they're quite different from blueberries, and they have flavors that are quite different, and the growing conditions are quite different. One of the things that I think is most interesting is that among the 400 blueberry species of the world, there's a wide range of flavors that you cannot encounter in the type that we've domesticated. So the one I'm working on now mostly is called the deerberry, and it's native on the scrubby white sands of Florida. It has probably the largest berry of any vaccinium maybe in the world, certainly in North America. The skin is a bit bitter when you eat it, and the berries fall off the plant when they're ripe, and you cannot easily clone it, are reasons why it was never domesticated. But it has an interesting feature in that if you open the berry of a cultivated blueberry, they're green inside. They only become black when you make a pie, or purple, because you break the cells of the skin, and the anthocyanin in the skin then permeates the whole body of tissue. It makes the berry look very purple. But if you just peel a fresh blueberry, it's green inside, or white. These deerberries, the ones that have black fruit on the... if the skin is black, it's black inside. And the pigments that make blueberries so healthy for you are many of them related to these pigments in the skin. So the Europeans who are used to eating a wild blueberry called a bilberry are quite disappointed when they find out that the American blueberries are green inside. So they want purple berries inside. And I have discovered that you can cross the deerberry with the blueberry and get purple hybrids. So they're purple inside. And I'll show you some of those in a minute.
Okay. Well, great for me, not so good for someone listening, but I'll tell you all about it another time, or maybe in a few years we'll be able to see Dr. Lyrene's creations in the grocery store, or have them in your Wheaties. But thank you so much, Dr. Lyrene, for speaking with us here today. It's Dr. Paul Lyrene, who's Professor Emeritus here at University of Florida, talking to us on Talking Biotech about the domestication and modern breeding of blueberries. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I think you can see why I get so jazzed about having the crop domestication and breeding as a portion of this podcast, because the stories are interesting and the history is really cool. And it reminds us that really we're dealing with a very recent development in human history and in civilization, that the ability to take plants from the wild and bring them into our control is not really necessarily an ancient activity. And we'll talk about some crops that have a little more history and time than blueberry coming forward. But that's it for today's version of Talking Biotech. I thank Dr. Allison Van Enenem and Dr. Paul Lyrene. And thank you very much for listening. And welcome your questions to the hashtag Talking Biotech. My name's Kevin Folta. Thank you so much for listening. And we'll see you again next week.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Please send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to Talking Biotech at gmail.com. Please write a review on iTunes and recommend this podcast to a friend. More downloads and reviews raise the visibility of this podcast and help us reach a wider audience with science.